Welcome to a slightly different episode of Venturi's Voice. In the first half of the show, I catch up with CEO Gemma to talk about the business of Culture Shift. And in the second half of the show, I catch up with Chris and Carl to talk about the technical side of things. Welcome to the show, guys. Today we're joined by Gemma McCall, who is CEO of Culture Shift. It's great to have you join us today. Thanks so much for taking the time to do this with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. I mean, we've got so much to talk about, and the more I kind of read about Culture Shift and the more I talk to people about it, the more it amazes me, really. It's for me, it's the epitome of meaningful technology, and it really is what I find is when technology is actually at its best, and it really is making a difference these days. It's fantastic. But we can't talk about an hour, you can't talk for an hour about just me blabbing on about how much I like it without people knowing exactly what it
is. You could, if you want. I would really enjoy listening to that.
for the listeners' sake, let's say, could you give us a bit of background on what Culture Shift exactly is?
Yes. So we are, Culture Shift is a tech for good provider, and our software allows anyone who's experienced or witnessed any kind of harassment or abuse to report it, either with their name or keeping themselves anonymous, and access further support for what they've experienced. So that's kind of sort of phase one, if you like. And then for organizations that license the software, they are able to obviously deal with things on a case-by-case basis, but then also understand sort of prevalence and whether there's any worrying trends within their organization, and then take a proactive approach to be able to tackling that. So if there is bullying in the finance department and a load of anonymous reports come in about that, then the organization can like intervene and do something about that before it escalates to people leaving and things like that.
Brilliant. I mean, there's so much we can talk about around this whole kind of the bigger picture, and there's so much we're going to talk about. So, but I mean, we were talking a little bit before we hit record, and you mentioned that you fell into this tech area, I mean, by accident. So could you give us a bit of insight into that?
Yeah, so my background is in sales, and I started my whole career in media and advertising sales. And I guess the reason why sometimes I have a little wry smile to myself when people like describe me as a female tech founder, which I'm very proud to be described as that, but it makes me smile a little bit just because, you know, I'm not a techie, I'm not a developer, but I can, you know, put the message out there and sell, you know, the tech. And I think, you know, when it comes to talking about like women in tech, and just having a bit more of an understanding of like what goes into tech and being a tech company, it's not just developers, you know, it's there's so many roles involved in being in a SaaS business. Mm-hmm. But I smiled to myself because, like, you know, I was setting up my Wi-Fi network at home, and absolutely it took me all weekend this weekend. Yeah. So that's why I have a little wry smile to myself. But so I started out in media sales and then moved into agency sales, where I started working at a branding and digital agency. And it was just at that point where people were kind of stopping advertising in newspapers or in like the yellow pages and spending their marketing money there. And they'd realized that the internet and having a website was an incredibly useful tool to sell your products and services with. And so that was kind of my early digital, and, you know, so continued kind of on that journey of blimey selling all sorts of different like websites. Like, do you remember Flash websites?
Oh, vaguely, yeah.
Like when everyone wanted a Flash website because it looked really, really good, but then no one could find it on Google. So then it all had to be changed. Yeah, you know, carried on that journey through working in a kind of branding and digital agency. And then latterly, since we started developing our software or our product, then kind of moved into product and software development. So it's, you know, I wish I could say that when I was a little girl, I saw all the inequalities in the world, and I knew that I wanted to change it. And so therefore I saw my destiny as, you know, being a tech for good founder. But unfortunately, it's not as romantic as that. It's all happened by mistake rather than by design.
Yeah, I love that though, because I mean, you gotta think life is serendipitous a lot of the times, and you know, obviously, all the stuff that's happened in your past has led up to this, and this is a great thing that you're doing. But I was just thinking, what's the catalyst for the business itself? Was it an experience you've had, or what was it?
So I've definitely experienced discrimination in my, like, throughout my life and career. Most sort of notably is my experience in trying to return to work after I'd had my kids. Right. So maternity discrimination. The reason why we started working on Report Support, which is what our software is called in higher education market, is because there was a lot of research that said prevalence of sexual harassment and violence in amongst female students at university was incredibly high. Wow. But reporting levels were incredibly low. So the report by the NUS back in 2010 called the Hidden Marks Report was found that 80% of female students at university would experience some kind of sexual harassment or violence during their time there, but only 2% would report it, which is just kind of, it hurts my brain. Yeah. Thinking about. Yeah. It. And there are many reasons why people don't report that sort of experience. But one of the reasons for reporting levels being so low was because it was difficult to report.
Right. Okay.
So you would have to go and fill out a form. That means speaking to someone to say, could I have the form to fill out, please? Yeah. And that's just, you know, there's so many kind of points along that journey where someone could talk themselves out of making the report. Mm-hmm. So our initial reasons for developing it was because we wanted to create online space that anyone could use 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 a year, at a time and place that felt safe to them, and give the opportunity to stay anonymous, so that, because people, another massive barrier to reporting is if you reveal yourself and start having a conversation with someone about it, they might not believe you. You fear the repercussions of you saying, this happened to me. Yeah. You know, people feel like they might be seen as like the troublemaker or things like that. So there's so many kind of barriers in your way. And so that was the first part of like developing the whole system, was to be very reporter centric, understand those barriers and start to dismantle them.
I was thinking about at work as well, and in the workplace environment, and you know, if there's small issues that happen at work and they're not nipped in the bud because people just think they're not big enough, or they feel kind of silly going to raising it to HR because it's not that big a deal. Mm-hmm. But actually, mm-hmm. these small things end up being massive, like huge.
Definitely.
And have a massive impact on mental health, and actually can result in someone, well, obviously, you know, leaving the business. And and that's the last thing that a business would want, really.
Well, that ends up, you know, being very, so kind of best case scenario in that scenario that you just painted for the organization is that that person leaves, because that's the sort of least expensive option, although that is very expensive, because, you know, like if that person's been disengaged or, you know, for a long time, that's cost the business money. It costs business to recruit to replace that person. So, but that's kind of, I'm not saying that's best case scenario, by the way, I'm just saying that's best case for the business. Worst case is that person decides that because their employer didn't act on what was happening to them, they take them to a tribunal. So employment tribunals are, like when you talk about sexual harassment, 70% up year on year. Then if the finding of the tribunal is that the person, you know, that the case is upheld, then the employer has to pay their legal fees, the person's legal fees, and the award amount.
Wow.
So last, you know, that's, and that can go into hundreds and thousands now, because the tribunal courts really want to set an example, really, and kind of prove to employers that it's not acceptable to just turn a blind eye to it anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, either way, though, allowing problematic behavior to kind of fester in your organization costs a lot of money, like no matter kind of which way you cut it. So it's really important that employers take it seriously and allow a speak up culture so that people don't just go, oh, well, I'll, you know, talk themselves out of saying something. I think we're going to see like a huge, a real kind of example of kind of the picture that you've just painted there of things being, feeling too little to actually report, but actually do make a significant difference is microaggressions that people of color, you know, since the kind of discussions that we've been having around race, since what happened in the summer with Black Lives Matter, that's kind of triggered a lot of people to kind of go, actually, I've been putting up with those behaviors for my entire career and I'm not going to anymore, like, because it's not right. I shouldn't have to put up with someone touching my hair because I've got afro hair, for example. And so I think we're gonna, you know, employers should allow a speak up culture so that they can help people understand kind of what is and isn't acceptable behavior, because even though it's surprising that we still have to have those conversations, we definitely still do have to have them.
Absolutely. And there's one thing that strikes me is, you know, how do you change the perceptions of, say, senior members of staff or business leaders who, you know, have unconscious bias about these things? How can you change that perception?
Well, I do think it kind of keeps, it comes back to understanding, collecting data and understanding and interpreting that data that you're collecting. So obviously through our system, you would be collecting real examples of someone's experience in the workplace. So that's kind of one like aspect of the data. But then if you measure attrition rate, and you measure, you know, like you've the organization has a commitment to diversity and inclusion, and so therefore you want to hire more diversely and you're succeeding in that, so you're employing more people of color, for example, but then they're leaving like however long afterwards, you need to kind of put all of that data together and see whether it's telling you something. So you're recruiting more people, your recruitment drives are going well, but their experience within the workplace isn't a good one. It's not a welcoming place for people of color. They're experiencing microaggressions and things like that, and so then they leave. You need to kind of understand the data in your organization and interpret it, and then take a proactive and preventative approach to having those conversations and, you know, doing unconscious bias training or, you know, whatever it may be. But you can't just kind of passively sit there and go, oh God, you know, that's a shame, isn't it? Like, you have to proactively read and understand, interpret the data and put things in place so that you can change the status quo.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, throughout this conversation, I've been having flashbacks to a place where I used to work. And there used to be, it was almost like an online form that they'd send out every month and say, you have to fill this out. And it was it was supposedly anonymous. I'm not sure. I mean, it didn't feel like it was. Or it kind of felt like they could tell who it was by the tone of voice you were writing the comments in. And it was almost all the questions that were there were questions that they wanted answers to. It never seemed to be, you know, at the forefront of their mind, like, what's the issues? You know, what can we do to make your life at work better? It was kind of leading you in a way to make them feel like they were really good, you know, and kind of just like,
confirming that it's a good place to work rather than,
And it really
and I think
wasn't
that's,
either.
We have that conversation. I think we have that conversation a lot with them. You know, we say, oh, you know, like, do you how can people tell you if they're unhappy or if they've experienced anything? And the answer that tends to come back is, well, we do an employee engagement survey once a year, which is great. And, you know, people should do employee engagement surveys and measure, you know, to, like, at a moment in time, measure the overall engagement within the organization. But like you've just said there, first of all, no one believes that that's anonymous.
Yeah.
So they don't say what they really feel in it. And also, I can barely remember, and maybe this is a lockdown thing, but I can barely remember how I felt 2 weeks ago, let alone like what has been my experience here in the last year. So you are just like taking a snapshot at that one particular piece of time. Whereas if you've got, if you're encouraging a speak up culture and you have a reporting system available to anyone who's experiencing anything 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365, you're allowing people to say how they feel when they want to, rather than on the day that you send the employee engagement survey out.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a different thing. Like that's still useful data, but it's not the only bit of data that's reliable.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting that you say that, because I'm having flashbacks again, PTSD. I'm fine. I just need to lie down after this. But I remember, because it was only once a month that we had these forms. And if I was in a good mood on that day, I'd just be like, oh yeah, everything's great, great, great. But what I realized I should do was wait until I was in quite a bad mood, or maybe, you know, we've run out of coffee or I didn't get enough sleep. And then all the issues that were actually a problem that were really affecting me would come out. So it's so important to have something, you know, available 24 hours a day. That's so important. And that's amazing.
And I think another thing that employers sort of forget is that, so encourage people to tell you if they're unhappy or if they've experienced, you know, sort of an issue. But also you need to communicate what's been done about that.
Definitely.
Because if you aren't transparent and you're not communicating that on a regular basis, people will stop telling you. So that's another kind of piece of the puzzle that organizations forget, that you need to be transparent and you need to communicate what action you've taken. Because another thing that we find when we're like, this comes back time and time again in our research, is there's a distrust in HR to do the right thing and look after the employee.
Yeah.
And people didn't tell the organization what was happening to them because they didn't think anything would be done about it. Those are like two constant things that we are hearing.
Yeah.
And so the organizations have to, because you can say what you've done. And some of the best organizations that we work with share a quarterly report with publicly, say, this is how many reports we've had, this is what the reports were about, and this is what we've done as a result of that information. And that's, you know, not breaking, you know doing it in a data protection and GDPR safe way. But you're still able to tell people what you've done as a result of the reports coming in. So there's so much that you can do, but I just think people don't really understand what you can do.
Yeah. Have you noticed any industries in particular that are quite slow on the uptake, not taking harassment, you know, seriously?
I think there are some that are taking it more seriously than others. But I think it's really difficult. I think a lot of organizations taking like the first minimal steps that they possibly can.
Yeah.
So for example, at the moment, we're seeing loads of like racial harassment work policies being rewritten or rewritten. And then like publicly, you know, it's being said, oh, we've done this. And policy writing is possibly the sort of easiest bit of that, because everyone can say, oh yeah, well, we've got a policy, so that's it. It's the easiest step that can be taken, and it's how that policy is lived and breathed and used. And so I don't see many sectors really doing something beyond policy change or sharing a black square to say that they support Black Lives Matter on their social media. Like I don't have like a whole host of examples of here's where excellent practice is happening, unfortunately. And I wonder whether the action actually will only be taken if there's legislative change.
Yeah.
And there is a law review at the moment to review the harassment at work laws, but obviously because of COVID and everything, you know, that's slowed down significantly, which is understandable, but you know, doesn't help the people that are being harassed today.
Yeah, definitely.
Very much.
Definitely. And I was just wondering if you've got any advice for a company that wants to completely, you know, renovate their supportive culture. And I mean, what would be the best procedure they could do, or how should it be done, you know, perfectly, in your opinion?
So I think I'll be really honest and say, like, we're still learning about kind of what is best possible, like, thing to do. But allowing people to report truly anonymously is a positive step. Encouraging that speak out culture and removing those barriers to reporting, particularly in the workplace where people fear the repercussions of their careers. They don't want to be seen as a troublemaker. They don't want to harm their own career. You know, so I think, yeah, and kind of like I've said before, being open and transparent and saying, we want you to report. And then when you launch the reporting system, say, okay, these are the reports that we received, and this is what we're going to do as a result of that, that information. Because we've seen, you know, so we've been licensing our product for about 4 years now. And we've seen over that time that kind of year one, you will receive probably more anonymous reports than named reports.
Yeah.
But then year two, if you communicate the action taken off the back of that information, then it flips from anonymous reports to more named reports. And if someone names themselves, then there is more that you can do to support that person through what they've experienced. So it's communication transparency is absolutely key, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're obviously all of us are working from home now. How has that affected things?
So since you know, COVID all kicked off, one of the kind of top things that people say to me is like, oh, I bet your system is being used less because you can't bully, you know, you can't bully someone if, you know, you're not in the office with them. And unfortunately, that's just not the case.
Yeah.
And there's still research to be done on it. But a couple of weeks ago, an organization called The Rights of Women released a survey that asked about women's experiences in relation to harassment. And there's basically been a surge in online harassment in this time.
Wow.
And that's both on social media, but basically the abuse has like increased and gone online.
Right.
So unfortunately, even though you would have thought that things might be feel a bit safer, it's the opposite, unfortunately.
It's really interesting, and it seems if you don't have this kind of software, it seems that the avenues are more difficult to get through, you know, it's when reporting things to HR in a more formal sense, and it feels more difficult. I don't know. It's more difficult to talk to people, you know, than it has been.
And it's interesting what you say about kind of formally reporting to something to HR, because I think that's sort of another thing that people, or that employers are sort of resting on their laurels a little bit, because they go, well, we haven't had many formal complaints about it. And that doesn't mean that there isn't a problem, because there's a step before that formal complaint. Like, people don't really want to go through a formal process because people want the behavior to change. They don't necessarily want to get that person sacked because they don't want that on their own conscience. So the step before to truly understand what's happening in the organization is to, you know, is an informal report, or, you know, so that you can understand what's happening and take action based on that informal report rather than going through a formal procedure.
Yeah.
But just because there aren't a lot of formal complaints, doesn't mean there isn't a problem. It just means probably people are putting up and shutting up, which means they're not doing their best work, and ultimately they'd leave the organization.
Yeah, and I'd just like to say, keep up the amazing work you're doing at Culture Shift. It really is phenomenal, and I look forward to chatting with Chris and Carl tomorrow about the tech side of things. I think that'll be great. So
yeah,
looking forward to it. And I'd just
definitely
like to say, you know, thanks for taking an hour out of your day to chat with me today. Hope you've enjoyed the first half of the show. Welcome to the second half. This is where I catch up with Chris and Carl to talk about the technical side of Culture Shift. Today we're joined by Chris Northwood and Carl Sad, and they're both from Culture Shift. It's great to have you join us today, guys. Thanks for taking the time to do this. As I mentioned earlier, I've just had Gemma on the show, so I've got her insights into the business, but we're going to be talking on more of a technical front with you guys. So welcome to the show. Great to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, likewise.
It's a pleasure. So let's get things started. Could you give us a bit of insight into your career history and how you got into working in technology? And Chris, can we start with you?
Sure. So I'm a software developer by trade. So I did the very traditional academic route into the industry. So I went to university, did computer science, did a placement course, placement year whilst I was there, working in Oxfordshire, and got a job in Oxfordshire once I graduated. And then it was about this time when the BBC decided to move up north, move a significant part of the operations up north. So I applied to join a graduate scheme working out of the BBC in Salford, and I got on it and I moved back up north, and I spent many years there before leaving to go work in the private sector. And then I went back to the BBC, and then I left a couple of years ago now to do some freelancing. And it was at that point when I was introduced to Culture Shift, originally helping them out in their very early days as they were trying to scale the business, and was fortunate enough about a year ago now to have been offered the role as the head of development. So that's where I am now. And the other thing I'll probably drop in there is all along this time, I also wrote a book about my experiences and all the things I've learned about software development. And it's called The Full Site Developer, and it's available on all good retailers.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, that's great. that's a really interesting story. And Carl, how about you? What's your background?
I'm not actually specifically from a tech background. I'm actually trained as a graphic designer. So I started my career working in various different branding and design agencies in the centre of Manchester. Some bigger ones, some smaller ones. Mostly working on sort of marketing, e-commerce, portfolio style websites, and obviously some branding on that as well. But more from the kind of design side as opposed to the sort of, you know, coding or programming, developing. Then about 10 years ago, I co-founded a business called Trust, which is basically a branding and digital agency. And we worked on basically delivering similar type of projects that I'd worked on throughout my career, as I mentioned earlier. But we also had the opportunity to work on a number of products, fairly small ones, for some of our retained clients. And one of those was actually the original reporting system that we developed for University of Manchester, mm-hmm. which ultimately led us gave us the opportunity to create Culture Shift, really. As soon as we kind of launched the first system for Manchester, we started getting inquiries from a number of other universities who were interested in launching something similar. And we thought, actually, it seems like this is something that could potentially be an interesting opportunity. We ran the two businesses in parallel for a couple of years, and we decided, actually, this is something we're all really passionate about, and it's definitely something that's sort of, you know, worth investing 100% of our energy in. So we decided to close the agency and focus 100% on Culture Shift. That was roughly a year ago, I think. Oh, I should also mention that we were successful in getting a first round of investment about a year ago, and that was something where we just thought, well, actually, this is what we want to do with 100% of our time.
Yeah, and I've heard on the grapevine that you were listed as one of the top 20 new businesses or startups to work for in Manchester. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It was quite a pleasant surprise. I don't think we knew we were even in the running. So yes, when that article came out, it's really good to know that. Now, even though we're still quite a small business, that people are, you know, recognizing us, and we've put a lot of effort into not only making sure that the business is helping our customers and our partners achieve the goal of, you know, making a world that's safe for work and study for people in those environments, but also internally we want to live those values. So making sure that the we have a really trusting team. We have a really, open team, and, and we want to kind of grow from there. So getting those foundations in place, I'm sure we've all heard the horror story of the startup founder, throwing tables and all that kind of stuff. That is the opposite of what Culture Shift are trying to do. Yeah. So really glad to have that recognized.
Oh, that's great. And you mentioned when you gave us the introduction that you were kind of brought in, and a part of your role is to kind of help scale the business. So this business can scale hugely. And I was just intrigued to find out how you've prepared for that.
So from the technical perspective, one of the things that we did is the very first reporter support system was built just for one university. It was built for Manchester. So every time a new customer was brought on, it involved basically copying Manchester's site, making the tweets and putting it live. Or what you ended up doing is you just end up having more and more servers, one server per customer. And the challenge at the time I was asked to help with the business was to build what we were calling version 2 of the product, which was a system that would be allow us to not have to go through that quite involved manual process of setting up a new server every time we onboarded a client. Otherwise we'd have ended up with Amazon bills, much, much bigger. So we moved into the cloud. Well, we were in the cloud before. We fully embraced AWS, fully embraced the serverless methodology, and introduced some of the best practices that kind of are used in the product space around DevOps and continuous delivery to help the technical side of the business scale. And what we have now done, kind of between me and Carl, with Carl's design head and my technical head, is we've tried to make sure that we're now taking a kind of product-led approach in terms of how we build out the offering. So this is things like working with the whole business. So, how can we automate or, help support our customer service reps, who we call our partnership and our success team and our partnership managers, and how can we help them enable them to do their jobs better? Because I think coming from this kind of agency background where project managers and account managers are very full-on roles, that helping scale that side of the business as well.
I think There's the technical challenges in terms of all the things Chris spoke about with our sort of AWS infrastructure. There's also in terms of us actually deploying a new site and bringing on a new customer. Even though we've solved a lot of the technical challenges, there's still a lot of sort of handholding that goes on in terms of actually setting up the site. So uploading all the kind of question forms, all the content on the website. There's at the moment still quite a lot of manual work that we have to undertake to actually launch a new site. So what we're currently working on as one of our sort of strategic priorities is self-service. So the ultimate goal is to be able to sell a system in our sleep. That means, the whole journey from the kind of marketing and sales through sort of the accounts and terms of, terms of service and actual onboarding and delivery and sort of launching the site, all of that can be done through the product itself or through the marketing website from end to end. Whereas currently at the moment, it still actually involves quite a lot of our physical time and also quite a long time into, weeks basically to go through that whole process potentially.
And I think that the challenge there is not just that we don't just sell our product and a website. We are selling the whole service of, helping people go on that journey of culture change. So it's not just like, a lot of software as a service providers where you go on the website, you do your free trial, you get your product, and there's a bit of a, user guide there. But because our product, we don't want to just be a checkbox. We don't want someone to say, oh, we have a reporting system, fine, let's move on. We need to make sure that actually our partners have all the systems in place to actually be able to manage those reports that come in. Because if you're someone who's, for example, experienced sexual assault and you've reported it via our tool, that is just the start of your journey. And that's why the original name of the product was reports and support. And we've now moved to Culture Shift because we want it to be more than just reporting and supporting. But it was always report and support just from the very start.
Yeah. And I was mentioning before we started recording here that the more I kind of learn about Culture Shift as a product, the more amazed I am by it. And it really is tech for good. And it's, for me personally, I think this is the most exciting area that, you know, of new technology being implemented into the real world and making a real difference. And it's phenomenal. It really is. And
can we have this as a quote on our website?
Okay, fine. Please do. Yeah. Please do. But it is amazing though, because I was saying to Gemma on our recording earlier that it's like, I can't believe that in, you know, even last year, I know I had people close to me who were having issues at work, and the only way they could really voice their opinion would be to formalize it through HR and those kind of things. Yeah. And it's not anonymous.
It's one of these kind of like classic Hitchhiker's Guide, you know, you have to go down the stairs and behind the post in the lavatory of the post where the leopard is, where's the reporting form is, and you drop it in a box. And one of the interesting design challenges we have is how do we balance the needs of the organization that are buying it with the needs of the victim or survivor, because obviously from the point of view of the organization, one of the things we offer is the ability to generate proactive insights. You know, are we getting more reports than we would expect from a particular area of the business? You know, are we getting overrepresentation, for example, of BAME people reporting, in which case maybe we need to do some proactive outreach around racism. And collecting the data to help the organization do that is one thing. But I think sometimes you end up, certainly historically, with these forms that ask you to potentially relive quite traumatic experiences. So we've had to design our reporting system such that, you know, it has to feel comfortable, because we are asking people to, you know, say what happened to you. And that can be quite a harrowing experience to go through. But at the same time, we don't want to necessarily bombard them with questions. So how do we get the information that we need, that our partners need to be able to do the support? And that's one of the hardest design challenges that we have in our system.
Mm, particularly because we don't actually ever get to meet those people, and we're unlikely to, because obviously they're not our customer, you know. So in terms of the sort of the research and testing for that side of the product, that's got its, you know, that's quite a challenging aspect of it. Whether we've actually nailed that, yeah, as much as we could, there's certainly, we know that that's an area of the product that we could definitely improve, and that's on our roadmap at the moment. So
did you have to get any outside help, you know, from other professionals in this industry to kind of help guide the way of the direction of the questioning?
Yeah, so and the initial system that was built, V1, was actually built in conjunction with the University of Manchester's Equality and Diversity and Inclusion department. And, you know, we spent quite a lot of time crafting that process and making sure that those questions were, you know, easy. It was step by step, very clear, very simple, very easy to follow journey. Although that's hasn't changed a huge amount since we first launched the product. So as I say, that's why I think it's an area that we would like to go back and revisit, you know, potentially in the next sort of 6 to 12 months.
So, you know, one of the key things about our product that differentiates it from a lot of systems that came before is the fact that we enable anonymous reporting. I think this came out of the research that kind of kicked off Manchester's request for trust to do the project. Was, I believe it was Universities UK, was that right, Carl? This research that basically said,
yes,
like how many incidents were occurring that were actually being just going unreported. And a lot of it is because people feel a deep amount of shame if they've been a victim of sexual violence, which is, it's not what we'd have in an ideal world. They would feel love and support to be able to do it, but that is what happens. So we have to design for the reality that exists. So that's why anonymous reporting, which is the crucial step, I think, that Report and Support offered over, you know, the alternatives that were available at the time, existed. And that was quite a lot of academic research that's gone into that. And I think we've been quite fortunate through starting in the university sector, where, you know, we are now the market leader for higher education in the UK, that the academic university sector does a lot of academic research and it's published. So we've been fortunate enough to feed into that and also benefited from, you know, we have had academics at some universities go work with, because, you know, we normally work in, say, student support services and those kind of things rather than the academic teams, but academics working, you know, in the wider university have then contributed their expertise to some of our clients to help them do that. So that's been really, really helpful for us. And then we have, you know, publicly been open and shared that amongst all of our kind of partners, so they can benefit from that within their own system.
One of the things that we've found around the anonymous reporting is that actually, if for many people that becomes the first step, and then what they do is they then make a report and happy to name themselves sometimes later down the line. But yeah, the anonymous is like a first step, although some organisations find that anonymous reporting quite a scary sort of prospect.
Yeah,
but it really works. You know, we've proven that.
There's a key mindset to our partners have to get over, which is getting reports is a good thing, because you know these incidents are happening. Therefore, getting reports means that they're getting reported. Not getting any reports doesn't mean the incidents aren't happening. This means they're not being reported. So that's actually a bad thing. So getting a lot of reports might feel bad because all of a sudden you've had the veil lifted, but it's actually good because now you're in a position to be able to do something about it. All of our customers want to do the right thing. That's why they work with us. So we're very lucky in that regard. You know, we don't really have anyone who, you know, has bought us for checkbox size. But, you know, it's also I really feel for our sales team, because, you know, they are asking people to actually make quite a hard decision. So it's like you have to face up to the fact this is happening, and then this is going to, you know, be part of your journey, and, you know, hopefully shift your culture, as the name of the company implies. But so it's a tough sell, but it's offers so much value if people are strong enough to be able to, you know, to work with us.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I imagine the reporting data that's come out of your software is very, very different compared to what was gone before. I mean, are the statistics completely different now?
Yeah, so it's certainly just the sheer number of reports. You know, previously, you know, a lot of universities that work with, you know, they either had, it was a paper report, or you had to book an appointment with a counsellor to go in and tell them what happened. And, you know, we know through psychological research is saying something out loud, you know, saying I have been raped is a huge barrier for people.
Definitely.
But writing it down is it's still hard, but it's less of a barrier. So that is why the online system, you do see an increase in reports.
I've also been thinking about the user experience side of things, because this the product is going out to, you know, loads of different people with all different knowledge levels of technology. So how do you make it usable and user friendly for everybody in mind?
Lots of testing and research. we're really big on that. Wherever we possibly can, we'll be doing research before, testing afterwards, and we just, you know, continue that process. We're very keen, and we're always engaging with our customers. You know, we're constantly holding, you know, research sessions, making lots of notes, exploring every different angle we possibly can.
Yeah, and I think from a technical perspective, we've taken a fairly conservative approach
right. In
how we built the technology out. So, you know, everyone is into the latest Vue, React, whatever, Svelte. Ours is bog standard vanilla JavaScript, and we've taken progressive enhancement, you know, as if it was the mid-noughties again, because that is the approach we want to take. You know, we put accessibility so high up the backlog, you know, that if we find an accessibility bug, number one priority is to get fixed that. Well, number one is always security, and then number two is accessibility. But there are, you know, how we rank bugs. So we take, you know, browser support and progressive enhancement and all those kind of like technical approaches, which maybe are less trendy nowadays, but are still valuable in order to help us maximize that. You know, we never ever want someone to come to our website and find they can't report because, you know, they're using an older laptop, they're using an old computer, or, you know, there's an interesting study that we found, which is especially in domestic violence situations, if there's only one laptop, this is not just us, that's industry research, it's industry wide, but people will, for example, use the web browser and a switch or games console to access it. So applying those like very fundamental core techniques has given our platform that capability for reporters to be able to go to it and use it.
I think just going back to what you were saying before about the reporting, that thing where in the past it was, a piece of paper or going to visit someone, obviously now it's always on, always there. If they want to make the report at 2 o'clock in the morning, when that can be done, it's just so much more accessible than the previous routes to, making a report.
We have some anecdotal evidence from some of our partners that Sunday evenings are the biggest time to receive reports.
Oh, right. Yeah, that kind of makes sense, doesn't it? That kind of Sunday evening anxiety. And then when all the emotions come up actually for your week ahead, that's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, usually at this stage of like the interview, I usually ask what's the biggest obstacle that you've come across. Yeah, what's the biggest obstacle? But I kind of think that's a bit negative. I just kind of want to flip it and do the opposite, really, and just think what's the greatest achievement that this product has brought out?
So we can now reach 1 million.
I was just about to say that. Yeah.
Is it? Have we reached 1 million yet, or is it like 970,000 still, Carl?
It's
something around there. I don't know if we've quite yet. But
it's huge numbers.
970,000 people can now access support in a way that they couldn't before, and we hear from our partners how much they. So there was one story recently where someone had submitted a suicide note via the system, and because they'd done that, the university was able to find them, reach out to them, give them the help they needed. So, and when we heard that, everyone in Slack just like broke down, because like, my God, we've saved someone's life. And that is when you really feel what we're doing. Because in a day job, it's very easy to get, it's like, oh, there's a bug, oh, it's IE broken again. But then we get that, we know the real impact we're having, and it feels really good to be doing that kind of work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's been certain moments that have really brought home to me how important what we're doing is, because like Chris said, it's very easy to forget that. There's been instances where we've been to conferences and we've heard survivors or victims telling their stories, and particularly in the university setting. For me, I'm thinking, that my daughter's going to be there in 8 years' time. And if something like that happens to her, I'd like to think that there's, a system like a cool shift in place to help. And that's when it really, it really hammers it home, and it sort of makes it a reality and something that you can really relate to. I definitely think that the value of what we're doing is, we're lucky that we're making a difference like we are.
Yeah, I'm completely blown away by this product. I really am. It's phenomenal. And like I mentioned before, I do absolutely love it. And don't get me wrong, I don't say that on every podcast, although you might think I do, I don't. So, I'm really looking forward to seeing, following the culture shift journey and seeing where it is, 6 months' time or a year's time, because, there's some, it's really on a great path.
We're about to go into another round of funding, which will hopefully allow us to grow the business even more. And we really want to kind of, industry leaders in the higher education sector, the ambition is, can we do that in other spaces, within the public sector, for example, within local authorities or public services, but also in heavily regulated parts of the industry where we know there are issues, the Law Society have written about the experience of sexual harassment and sexual violence within the law industry. And from the financial services sector as well, there were well-known problems and cultural problems within that. So our our ambition is to break into those markets and make a difference in the same way that we have in the higher education sector. So if anyone of your listeners is listening and they're working in that sector, www.culture-shift.co.uk, and come and have a chat, and we will see how we can help you and get the system in place.
Yeah, excellent. And thanks so much for taking the time to do this with me today. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I've really enjoyed chatting with you. So thanks so much.
Thanks for having us on.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you very much. Likewise.
Chris, can you plug your book one last time?
Yeah. So the book is The Full Stack Developer. It is published by Apress, and it covers 50-50 split between the technical skills you need to be a good and effective full stack web developer and the non-technical skills that are not often covered in software development courses that you would stand you in good stead to being an effective team player.
Perfect. What a great note to end on.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform.